This weekend is on the theme of intention. Intention and the power of thought. Did you come into this retreat with any particular intention? Just reflect for a moment. In fact, have you noticed your thoughts since you've arrived here? Have there been any? How many thoughts do you think you thought in the last meditation session? 5, 10, 50, 500, 5,000? Did you recognize any as thoughts? Ah, these are thoughts. Mental phenomena. Present moment, mental phenomena. That's what's arising now. Or did you look at the content and think, that's a brilliant thought. Did anybody actually have a brilliant thought in the last session, the last sitting session? Sometimes we look at our thoughts and we realize, you know, I don't even want to be thinking this. When we look closely, we might realize that our thoughts are often not as insightful as we would wish they were. Thoughts tend to circle around habitual patterns. They're linked through association and repetition. And often, we honestly have to say they're not even very thoughtful. Instead of a skillful, directed, and wise application of our minds, even the most intelligent person finds their mind wanders an awful lot, fueled by proliferating tendencies of mind, what in the Pali language is called papancha, these proliferating tendencies or associations of thought. Sometimes papancha is translated as conceptual proliferation or diversification. It's the experience of starting with one thought and having it link and associate to another thought, and then another one, and then another one, and then another one, and another one, until we realize that we are nowhere near where what we began thinking about. This proliferation does very little to bring us to realize the truth of things, the nature of things, or to have a deep and intimate experience of life. In meditation circles, sometimes thought seems to be the enemy. And perhaps the term reflection as a wise use of the thought might have more positive implications. Reflection is an essential component of our practice. It could be described as a skillful use of thought. Reflection allows us to touch into our experiences and to let them move us, to be transformed by them. The Buddha taught what in Pali was called yonisomanasikara. Sometimes this is translated as wise attention or the wise use of the mind. The Buddha did not say, don't think. Thoughts arise. This is part of having a functioning mind and body. In fact, we wouldn't want to not be able to think. But we don't need to be limited to the conditioned patterns that rehash the same stories and content again and again. There's an art to skillful reflection, an art that can transform a repetitive level of that superficial thinking into a deeper reflection that has the potency to transform our lives. To support effective reflection, we need a calm mind. We need some concentration, some steadiness, some calmness and tranquility. So at the beginning of every retreat and at the beginning of a meditation practice, and very often in our daily practice, the emphasis might be on calmness, relaxation, coming into present moment awareness, developing this quality of samatha or samadhi. Calming and tranquilizing the mind is a skill in itself, and we can use the stable, still meditation posture. We can use the breath to calm the mind. We can cultivate calmness and tranquility in the body, in the way that we compose ourselves, and also in the way that we compose our mind, this peaceful way of being with the mind. If you find it's difficult to sit on the floor, you're very welcome to sit on a chair. There's no problem with sitting in chairs or on floors or cross-legged or kneeling, whatever you like. What posture helps you stay most steady and stable? What posture helps you settle into the meditative experience? But meditation should not create merely pleasant or placid states of quietude in the mind. Skillful meditation requires the development of wholesome factors, in particular what are called the 7 factors of awakening. These include mindfulness and investigation, effort and joy, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. 3 of these are arousing factors that bring up the energy and the interest, and 3 of them are calming and tranquilizing factors that help settle the mind. And then mindfulness is an inherently balanced and balancing factor. Peace of mind is not going to be sustained through a quietude or an equipoise. The deep peace will come through penetrative insight. And to realize this penetrative insight, we might need energy. It might be invigorating. It might even be joyful. Simply put, balanced factors support wisdom. Balanced mind creates the most conducive conditions for liberating insight. The Buddha taught 3 kinds of wisdom. What in Pali is called Suttamaya Panya, which is the wisdom or Panya, which arises through listening and hearing. There's Chintamaya Panya, which is the wisdom that arises through reflection and thinking. And there's Bhavanamaya Panya, which is the discernment that arises through cultivation and development. In the context of our practice, we need all 3 kinds of wisdom. First of all, listening is important. Deeply listening, perhaps to the experiences of the present moment. To listen to the body, to listen to the breath. To listen to the mind with an attitude that receives the experience just as it is, to patiently allow our experiences to unfold in clear awareness, moment by moment. We might even consider mindfulness to be a process of refining this capacity of deep listening. But traditionally, this teaching on Suttamaya Panya refers to how we listen to the Dhamma teachings. I'm really glad you've all come here to practice meditation, to listen to the teachings, to take a weekend out of your busy lives and focus on the Dhamma, to connect with yourself, to connect with life, to connect with the experience of the present moment, whatever it might be. Sometimes it seems so convenient and efficient to just download podcasts of Dhamma talks so that you can listen to them while you're driving or while you're working out at the gym. But there's something very important that happens when we come together in community, when we sit in silence, and interspersed in that silence are some Dhamma teachings. We can listen more fully. We can listen more deeply and perhaps be more profoundly moved and affected by the richness of these ancient teachings. In the Udana, the Buddha said, on that occasion, the Lord was instructing, rousing, inspiring, and gladdening the bhikkhus with the Dhamma talk connected with Nibbana. And those bhikkhus being receptive and attentive and concentrating the whole mind were intent on listening to the Dhamma. It describes that if someone were to clear his throat or make a noise, others around him would say, shh, be quiet. Because they wanted to listen fully. They wanted to concentrate on the teachings so fully that they could remember what was said and even be capable of accurately reciting it later. They weren't just casually listening, and they didn't expect the teachings to be entertaining. How do you listen to Dhamma talks? Now, probably when you listen to Dhamma talks, you don't intend to accurately recite it later. Most of us don't have that skill, that training, or that interest. But you might hear a Dhamma talk and feel a resonance with something in it. You might be moved by just a few words or a sentence. You might be intrigued by a reflective question. You might be caught by a remark. Some fragment of it might somehow seem intriguing to you and perk your interest. And so you can take that bit and reflect upon it. Cultivate cittamayapanya. Allow wisdom to arise through reflection and thinking. But it's easy to misunderstand what reflection and thinking means in this context, because some people hear the instruction to reflect, to contemplate, and then they trot back to their rooms and try to analyze everything that they just heard, compare it to other teachings that they've read about, other teachers that they've heard, compare this quote with that quote, and really tie themselves up in a lot of discursive knots. Contemplation in meditation is not that kind of comparing thought. Contemplative meditation involves a still and quiet approach to the use of our minds so that we enter into the experience that is present with curiosity and interest. We resonate with what we hear with curiosity and interest. The art of reflection depends on the willingness to listen patiently with interest, and to hold that interest or to hold a question intimately without trying to make it conform to things we already know or agree with our views or confirm our identity. We don't need to grasp a hold of an answer. We don't even need to understand what was said, and we don't need to gain an experience that we can later describe. Too often contemplation is cut short by this desire to grasp an answer and to get the satisfaction of that conclusion. We might feel complete because we know it, because we got it. But in contemplative reflection, we don't look for the answers. We certainly don't seek neat and tidy ones. We abandon the desire for conceptual completion and are simply sensitive to what is happening, to what touches us, to what we're receiving. Maybe it's a word or a phrase. Maybe it's just a title of a talk. Maybe we're touched by an encounter, the sensation of the breath, the colors in the sky at a sunset, the temperature of a tear, the sight of a bird. When we're touched by something, when we're intrigued by something or curious about something, maybe it's an experience, maybe it's a question, we learn to sustain a state of vivid interest without intellectually solidifying a conceptual answer, so that that state of interest maintains an engagement that can transform us. This is very different than just trying to remember what a talk was about, or trying to take super accurate written notes, or to try and pursue an analytical form of logical inquiry. Reflective contemplation is stiller. It's more open. We allow ourselves to simply be touched by something, whether we understand it or not. And sometimes we're touched by something so simple that we think it may not even merit our inquiry. I tell you, I have had life-changing insights while seeing a spider web hang from a doorway, while opening a door and feeling the temperature of the door handle. I had a life-changing insight while eating a sautéed mushroom and while hearing the grass blow in the wind, when watching ice melt, and when carefully observing the progression of a muscle spasm. There's so much simple that happens in the body, with the senses. This can be worthy of our reflection. Do you feel your breath right now? The sensation of the inhalation and the sensation of the exhalation. Sometimes when we feel the breath, we're touched by an intimacy with life. Not me and my life, but just life itself. What do we do when we're touched by the breath? Do we start to calculate the number of beings on the planet? How many of them are breathing air? Do we try to send loving kindness to everyone? What about just resting in that experience of being intimately touched by life? On an in-breath or an out-breath? Maybe you're experiencing pain. Pain in your back or pain in your shoulder. When you look closely, what do you find? Maybe you find a series of constantly changing sensations. Rather than analyzing the variations of sensations or become enthralled by the precision of your awareness or seduced by the variety and intricacy of these sensations or feel important, because you see them all changing. Allow the insight into impermanence to transform you. Change reveals our vulnerability. Anytime we're seeing change, in some way, it's a clue to our mortality. Seeing impermanence, we know that our experience is uncontrollable. It's not something that we can govern. It's not something that will conform to our wishes. It's utterly empty. So what have you been touched by in the last minutes, in the last hours, in the last day, in the last week? What is worthy of your reflection? Sometimes we ponder a question. Some of my favorites have been, what's actually happening now? What needs to be known to be free? What is a thought? Where is the love in this? What can be released? What can be let go of? Can this be said to be mine? It's not a project of trying to construct the most sophisticated and intelligent questions. There's no extra credit points for getting a good question, and certainly no extra credit points for getting a good answer. Instead, we use a question simply to open to experience, to be sensitive to what touches us, to feel into it, and to examine it long enough to awaken with it. When we sense the value of an insight or an experience, this is the time to reflect upon it, to allow it to mature, to feel the insight in every cell of our being. Reflection is said to milk the nectar of insight out of experience, because it functions to draw the liberating insights from the experience so that we're transformed in our spiritual life, so that that transformation informs the way that we live, so that we're no longer creating the causes for suffering. But we might consider at the beginning of this retreat, what are the obstacles to reflection? What hinders reflection? And I want to mention a few very common ones. The first is the desire to know, the desire to get the answer, the desire to be validated as an intelligent, accomplished person. Well, if we want to get the answer too quickly, then we might not stay long enough with the questions or the experiences for genuine insights to unfold. Another hindering force is a misunderstanding that meditation is simply better if we're not thinking. That in meditation, we shouldn't think. We should be so concentrated that no thought arises. If we hold this view of meditation, then we might spend so much of our time letting go of thoughts that we never take the time to cultivate the skill of the wise use of the mind. The third obstacle is the comparing of the experience that we're having now with a conceptual recognition of the teachings. Perhaps we've had an experience and we think that it conforms to something that we've heard about or read. Perhaps you experience the changing phenomena so clearly that you say to yourself, "Ah, I am at the stage of arising and passing," or "I am having the experience of emptiness." We might have genuinely begun to have a glimmer of insight, but if we move too quickly to conceptual formation, then we might abandon that direct experience in the present moment, compare it to preconceived ideas of things we've learned about, secure a self-identity, and grasp a hold of a concept, an idea of what our experience might mean. If we go too quickly to the concept, what's known, we've lost the profundity of the question or the experience. We don't need to compare our experience to what we think it should be or what we want it to be. We don't need to compare our experiences to the texts that we've read or to other people's experiences, or to what we hear in the Dhamma talks. We can let our process unfold in its own way, at its own pace. We might even want to slow our experience down, to settle into experiences so that we can be transformed by them, to value the delight of just hearing the Dhamma teachings, to resonate with joy at this opportunity to hear these teachings. We can refrain, pause, abandon the wish to reach for a concept, even if they're brilliant, even correct Buddhist concepts. Another hindrance to wise reflection might be an overemphasis on the here and now. Now, you're going to hear instruction, as I'm sure you have in previous retreats, on being present, being with the here and now. And this is wise instruction. I say it all the time, because if we're not present, we're lost in thought. And so we need to train our minds to be with what actually is happening so that we don't just drift off into a world of fantasy. It's important to practice interrupting that stream of proliferation, that stream of papancha, returning again and again to the here and now, sitting, breathing, feeling the body, sensing the experience, stabilizing the mind. Only when the mind becomes stable can we trust that we have the capacity to actually reflect, to reflect wisely. Because that's when an experience has a chance to reverberate and where we have a chance to see it deeply as it's happening. Or perhaps even reflect on something that already happened so that we learn from life's events. We can learn through reflection. This kind of reflection is not rumination that reinforces beliefs or creates worry or justifies grudges. Genuine reflection helps us see things in a fresh way. It's a way of seeing that loves inquiry and is fine with not having the answer. An inquiring mind is flexible. If you find that your mind is contracted, tightening, gripping in a process of analytical thinking, you might get headaches. You might feel tension in the face or the eyes. You might find yourself judging and getting grumpy and irritable, agitated. Recognize this movement of mind. Recognize the time when this I, the I-making, arises, where I want to understand. I want my belief confirmed. Let go of that grip of the I formation. Rest. Open. Settle again with not knowing. And trust that the Dhamma will reveal itself. Another potential hindering force is a cautionary note. I'd like to caution you about how you relate to the insight into impermanence. The seeing things change, understanding the pervasive impermanent nature of all mind and matter is a fundamental insight. It's a liberating insight because it frees the mind from grasping. But we have to be careful that we don't pounce so quickly on this insight into impermanence that we dismiss the experience that has just happened. Oh, it's just so impermanent. It's of no consequence. It doesn't matter. It's unimportant. It arose and passed away. I don't need to think about it. I don't need to reflect on it. I don't need to learn anything about it. It's past and gone. Now, some meditation techniques emphasize insight into impermanence at the exclusion of other qualities like effort, curiosity, renunciation, and reflection. On some retreats, it seems like whatever was happening in the sitting might seem so old by the time we have a chance to ask the teacher a question about it that it almost seems dishonest to even describe it. But if we never reflect on our experiences, we might lose the potency of those experiences simply due to lack of attention, lack of contemplation. I lived with a teacher in India for a number of years. Punjaji is his name. And one of the effects that he had on the Western meditative practices was a style that he had. He emphasized delighting in, taking joy in, making much of our experiences. People would sometimes report experiences to him that didn't happen in the room with him, didn't happen even in recent history. Some people reported experiences that happened 20, 30 years before. But nevertheless, with each experience, he made much of it. and encouraged people to write about it, to write poetry, to have joy and laughter, to reflect on their profound experiences. He honored and respected the insights that people had. But we have to be a little careful that we don't confuse honoring our insights with identification with our insights. Identification builds the self formations through attachment to that insight. Wonderful things happen in the meditation practice. Life-changing insights, transformative moments, profound deep states of bliss, amazing qualities of the wholesome mind, deep concentration, even stages of enlightenment. So we have to be careful that we're not overly impressed with our own accomplishments. Sometimes people experience a deep state of concentration and they rush to the teacher, want to know, was this the absorption state of the first jhana? Or they have an insight and they rush to the teacher, wanting to be confirmed to have had an enlightenment experience. Sometimes underneath the questions that we ask is actually a hunger for recognition or approval. But anything that is new to us might seem impressive. And so we have to be a little bit careful, cautious with our own experiences. Just as a child learns a new skill and is thrilled with it, we'll encounter many new skills as we develop the meditation and the mind. We'll encounter many new experiences. But just as a child learns and grows, and what was impressive as a 3-year-old is not really so impressive as a 40-year-old, we'll also develop in the meditation. And so we're encouraged not to gloat over our successes, because gloating can lead to complacency and pride. There's actually no selfing, no ego operating into deep insight. There's no self that could be confirmed or recognized. In the middle-length discourses, the Buddha said, "And when this venerable one regards himself thus, I am at peace. I have attained Nibbana. I am without clinging. That too is declared to be a clinging." We honor our experiences by reflection and diligent practice. By milking the honey out of our experiences, we may not need to keep creating more and more spiritual experiences. Recognizing impermanence brings insight into the conditioned nature of things, and it has the power to uproot clinging to the conditioned. But there is an understanding beyond all that is conditioned, an understanding that knows that impermanence is not the ultimate truth. Impermanence is only a characteristic of conditioned phenomena. If we're not overly fascinated with impermanence as the be-all and end-all of insights in insight meditation, we remain open to a possibility of discovering the unconditioned, the changeless, the deathless realization. Then perhaps the experiences that you've already had may be enough to awaken with. Or perhaps the experience that you're having right now is enough to awaken with. Let's have a few quiet minutes. these few silent minutes after the Dhamma talk, you can just let the mind be quiet. And just notice if anything of the talk resonates with you. Maybe a word or a phrase, a sentence or an idea. Maybe one small thing